I'm Wayne Winkler, the executive producer of Your Weekly Constitutional. After a decade of examining the United States Constitution, its creation and its creators, and how the Constitution impacts our everyday lives, this program is coming to an end. Today, I'll be joined by our host, Stuart Harris, and we'll look back at the creation and development of this program, some favorite episodes, and we'll talk about the future of the Constitution. It's Your Weekly Constitutional, one more time.
Welcome to Your Weekly Constitutional. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
It's Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Wayne Winkler, the executive producer of the program, and I'm here today with Chrissy Kuiper from WUOT and the host of the program, Stuart Harris. Well, Stuart, we understand that all things have to come to an end, and this is one of them.
Wayne, I'm getting unexpectedly teary-eyed to hear you say that. I've gotten so used to hearing your booming basso profundo over the last 10 years. But yes, all good things come to an end. They must. And this program is coming to an end as well. And I hate to disappoint anybody, and I hate it if anybody's sad by this. But as we were discussing just before we started this show, I guess that's better than nobody caring that we're leaving. So sorry if we're making you feel bad, but not that sorry. We're kind of glad you care.
Well, I'm sure listeners would like to know why the program is coming to an end. Have we addressed and solved all the constitutional problems?
Just the opposite, Wayne. In fact, there's a big part of me that feels like the show is more important now than it has been any time in its run. And indeed, there was a real frustration over this past year, as you know, when we were shut down by the pandemic. We stopped actually producing new shows, except for one exception when we did a fundraiser last fall. But we stopped producing new shows in the spring of 2020 for the same reason that so many other things shut down. In our case, we were doing the show in a tiny studio, a nice studio at ETS, but tiny. And, you and I would be sitting more or less shoulder to shoulder in that place. And we're both, of course, speaking into microphones that many people might use over the course of a day. And so it was almost impossible to be safe at that point. And so we simply said, okay, well, we've got 400 episodes on the podcast site, so why don't we just rebroadcast a few of them until this is over. And of course, at that time, nobody had any idea that we'd be going quite as long as we have gone. So we've been running reruns since, I think, about March of 20. And it was during that hiatus that I had time to think about this. We had gotten on that treadmill, good treadmill. I mean, happy to be on it, but it's a bit of a treadmill to produce a weekly show. And all of a sudden we weren't doing it anymore. And I had time to think about it and, whether it's something that I personally wanted to continue with. And I realized very strongly, very strikingly just how much time it takes to produce a show like that. We hope we make this seem easy. We hope it seems like we just get together and joke on the air. I see Chrissy smiling because she's a public radio veteran as well. That's always what you're trying to do. You want to make it seem effortless, but boy, for every hour you're on the air, there are many, many hours of preparation and production and distribution and social media responding and all the rest of it. So just an enormous amount of time. And quite honestly, I was happy to have that time back during the pandemic and, was able to use it for other things. There was another reason, and that is, sadly, like so many other historic sites, Montpelier, which has long underwritten the show, wanted to continue their association with us, but simply could not fund us the way they used to. And that's been for a couple of years now. And without going into details, Montpelier heavily, heavily subsidized the show. They did not completely cover all costs, but they put a big enough dent in it that I was able to cover the rest basically out of my own pocket these years. But Since Montpelier left, excuse me, that has become a much greater financial burden.
Of course, payroll wasn't part of the problem.
Not part of the problem. You know, you didn't get any enhancement to your enormous salary at from ETSU for doing the show, nor did I at my law school. And so, no, it's but there are lots of expenses. There are expenses of distribution. I mean, we actually have to pay to be on PRX, the public radio exchange, and paradoxically, the more popular we get, the more money we have to pay. And I see Chrissy over there nodding with understanding as well. And then things just like, you know, the podcast, you have to pay for the podcast hosting site. And that bill comes due once a year, and it's a pretty big bill. And I can hear people saying, well, why didn't you ask for more money? Why didn't you go out with Patreon or something else and try to raise money? And that was always an option. And in fact, I think if we'd continued, that was something that I was definitely going to look into. And it's not something you're ever going to make any money off of, but it's something that might have dented the outlay a little bit. But in all honesty, I was not optimistic that we could ever cover the shortfall that Montpelier left behind. And by the way, let me say this about that. My friends at Montpelier are wonderful people. It's a wonderful place. I still encourage everybody to go out there and see the home of the Constitution. And they were very, very clear that it had nothing to do with the show or the quality of the show. They were big fans. But they have just been hit really hard by the downturn in museum attendance over the past few years, which is just tragic as far as I'm concerned. I wish more parents would take their kids to Montpelier and Williamsburg rather than to, you know, Ripley's Believe It or Not or wherever they go. Be that as it may, financial problems, and then on top of that, the pandemic hit, and that just shut down all museums, I mean, for a long period of time. And so they're really having to rethink things, and they simply did not have the funding anymore. So no hard feelings there. In fact, warm fuzzies to all my friends at Montpelier, and real regret that we won't be working together nearly as much as we used to. And then finally, the third major reason from my perspective to end this is that we're getting old, pal. You and I.
Speak for yourself.
We're all getting old, for the record. I mean,
Chrissy is a mere child. I'm looking at her across the table here. I'm actually sitting at in Knoxville at UOT right now, and Wayne's joining us via Zoom. But you know, I just turned 60 this year, and yeah, I'm not going to retire tomorrow. But that's, you know, that's a big birthday, and you start thinking, well, this is the decade when people normally start retiring, isn't it? Maybe that's something I'll do. And if I'm going to do that, then you know, you start thinking about stepping back from some of your commitments, maybe handing them off to other people. And I should say that I did try to hand this show off. I won't mention to whom because I don't want to embarrass him, but a fellow who's been on the show many times and has been an absolutely wonderful guest and is a great friend of mine. And I called him up and we talked about it. And, you know, when I explained to him what it would take, he said, man, I've got a family. I've got kids at home. I can't make that commitment now. And I said, I understand. You know, I did this as an empty nest project. I did this after my, around the same time that my younger son was going to go off to college. So that's the only way that I had the time to spend on this. But that's the third reason. When you start thinking about retirement, you start thinking about stepping back from commitments and doing it in an orderly fashion. So we've given notice to all of our affiliate stations, hopefully that's, you know, enough. I mean, we notified them weeks ago. So, you know, with any luck, they'll be able to replace us with other high-quality programming. But those are the reasons. And, you know, it's sad, but it's not tragic. You know, and I hope we don't upset people too much. It feels like it's the right time.
Well, Stuart, let's talk about how the program got started. From my end, it started with an email.
Yes, that's right. Well, from my end, it started a little bit earlier. It started with a really nice picture of you. And I remember the picture, you were sitting in the studio that you and I would spend so much time in over the next decade, and you were being interviewed, I think it was by the Bristol Herald Courier. And I saw an article in there that said that WETS would be shifting its format up to that time, and this is back in 2010. You had what I think of as sort of the traditional or original public radio format, which is an eclectic mix of classical music, all things considered, you know, a couple of NPR shows, and then, you know, just weird stuff. You know, you never knew what you were going to hear on a public radio station. I mean, I loved ETS, but it was that format. And then you were going to go to what is now the current norm, which is more news talk format with little, if any, emphasis on classical music. And I should note here that WUOT actually does devote a great deal of time to classical music to this day. That's a conscious decision. And I would, I'm looking at Chrissy, that's probably a minority position, isn't it?
As far as I know, we are still in East Tennessee. We're the only classical music station.
Right.
Nashville has a classical music station.
But is it? But I'm talking about NPR affiliates.
Oh, no, no, no. It's not. That's not the norm anymore. We're
exactly.
definitely a minority.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're sticking more or less with what you had before.
We have a whole lot of people who have told us that we're their only source for classical music now.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a legitimate decision to make. But you were going to go in a different direction 10 years ago, Wayne. And I recall that, you know, reading this and finding it all interesting. And then toward the end of the article, you said, yeah, and we're hoping and we'll be looking for some more local programming. And this little light went off in my head. And I thought, wow, well, first of all, doing a radio show sounds like a heck of a lot of fun. And then secondly, you know, what would we do it on? Oh, well, what do I know about? I know about constitutional law. And moreover, I'm getting increasingly irritated by letters to the editor or posts online or other expressions by people who seem to have very, very strong opinions about the Constitution, but who clearly have not even read the darn thing. And there was just so much constitutional, it went beyond ignorance, it was vitriol. People weaponizing the Constitution. It was remarkable. The Constitution always seemed to support their particular preferences. I hope I won't offend anybody when I draw a comparison to what I call Bible thumpers. We've all seen them, haven't we? We've seen this or that preacher who's sort of a fire and brimstone preacher and who gets up there and waves the Bible around, sometimes quite literally. And it's just remarkable how the Bible always says what that preacher wants it to say. It's a big document. You can find lots of things in it. Same thing with the Constitution. You know, there are lots of things in the Constitution, and certainly constitutional history is very complex and lengthy. And you can find something you want in there, pretty much whatever your political persuasion. But whether the Constitution actually mandates this or that, and whether it's been interpreted in the way you want it to be interpreted, and those are different questions. And so I felt it was very important to try to increase the constitutional literacy of Southwest Virginia, East Tennessee. Quite honestly, I never thought the show would go beyond that region. And so that was part of the motivation. And so I came up with the idea for this show, and I wrote you a fairly lengthy email, if I recall. It was much longer than a typical email. And I sent it to you, and then guess what? You didn't respond.
No, not right away.
6 weeks, Wayne. You left me hanging for 6 weeks. Now, I may not be the guy, the world's most sensitive guy, but when you ask a pretty girl to the dance and she doesn't even respond to you, well, that's your answer. And so I figured that was my answer, that you weren't going to pay any attention to this clown from Grundy, Virginia, who wanted to do this show on this boring topic. But then I got a very nice email from you after 6 weeks where you explained that you thought it was an intriguing idea. And wouldn't I please give you a call? And so, of course, I did. As soon as I got the email, I got on the telephone and gave you a call, and we had a very pleasant, about 10-minute discussion, talked about the idea, and at the end of 10 minutes, you said, well, come on down sometime, and we'll start doing this. And that was a real thrill, and it was only after I hung up my phone up in my office there in Grundy that I realized that was my audition, wasn't it?
Kind of, yeah, that was.
Yeah, I mean, it's radio.
You know, you have to interest me first, and then we might have a shot at interesting an audience.
Yeah, and I think it's probably more than that, too, if I may say so. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my sense is that, you know, a person in your position who gets all sorts of proposals all the time, I mean, you're inundated with people who want to be on the radio or want you to carry their program on your radio. There has to be a certain degree of fit. I mean, everything from the way a person's voice sounds on the air to, you know, whether a person can express himself or herself in a good way or whether there might be some humor. I mean, all of those things, I'm sure, go into a decision on your part. And so I felt like I'd passed at least my first test. And that was in 2010. That was in the spring of 2010. And I figured, we'll be on the air in a week. Well, I kept thinking that until about a year later. A year later, we finally broadcast our first episode on March the 1st, I think, 2011. And the funny thing there is that we went through several different concepts. And every time we would record a sample episode testing out one of these concepts, I would actually send a recording of it on CDs. This was 10 years ago, and we'd, you know, online transfer of files was in its infancy. I would actually record them on, you would record them on CDs for me, and then I would mail them to my friends, some of my high school and college friends, you know, sort of a target NPR type audience. And the verdict was universal. I mean, almost word for word, you suck. This is terrible. And I realized it was because, you know, I was just lecturing people. You know, I was just getting on there and more or less following the syllabus of my introductory constitutional law class, because that was logical. You want to educate people. You start at the beginning. You go to this. You go to this. You talk about that. Yeah, but, it, you know, who wants to hear a series of lectures? In fact, really funny story. One of my friends named Jim, his wife is named Janine, and one day Janine was driving Jim's car, and Jim had all of these CDs loaded into his CD changer. And she didn't realize she was listening to CDs. She thought she was flipping through radio stations. And she came home that night and she said, "Jim, there's something wrong with the radio." "What do you mean, Janine?" Every station I turn to, there's just Blowhard Professor on there saying this. Oh my gosh, it was hilarious. A little disconcerting, but hilarious. And I think that was a breakthrough moment when I realized that a conversation is a heck of a lot more interesting to listen to than a lecture. And that's when we realized that we had to have at least one guest per episode. Who? Well, it could be anybody with a nexus to the Constitution. It could be certainly another law professor. We've done that many times. It could be a politician. It could be just plain folks who have gotten caught up in constitutional issues. Because that became one of the main themes of the show, is that, you know, constitutional law is not about law professors, and it's not about judges. It's not about politicians, really. It's about people. It's about all of us and how it affects us every day. So we interviewed lots of different people and from all different walks of life. And I think that's what made it fun. That's what people tell me, is they feel like they're just listening in on a conversation at someone's kitchen table. So that was one of the major developments. And once we got that down, then I think things started to roll. We came up with some ideas to break the show up. We had a series of things we called constitutional profiles. We kind of let that drop after a while, where we would do mini biographies of some constitutional figures. We had something that lasted all throughout the show, and that was our constitutional quiz. And the reason that lasted was because people really liked it, where we would, you know, quiz people on constitutional issues, and, you know, if they got them right, we'd give them a T-shirt, and everybody got a pocket constitution. So, you know, that's how it worked. And then things went on and they developed from there.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm executive producer Wayne Winkler, and I'm talking with program host Stuart Harris. We're joined by Chrissy Kuiper of WUOT-FM in Knoxville, Tennessee. And on this final episode of your Weekly Constitutional, we're talking about how the program came to be. We'll continue this conversation in just a few moments. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm executive producer Wayne Winkler, and today I'm talking with program host Stuart Harris about the program, which we're wrapping up due to many factors, chief among them a lack of time to do the program. But as we look back, Stuart, I wonder if we could talk about some of our favorite episodes. One of my favorite interview guests was James Loewen, who is the author of some of my favorite books, beginning with Lies My Teacher Taught Me, followed by books like Lies Across America, Sundown Towns, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader. I always enjoyed hearing from him, and the hour never seemed long enough to contain all the ideas he wanted to express.
Oh, now Jim Loewen was an absolute delight. Is an absolute delight. I think he's still with us. He is, as you say, the award-winning author of that huge bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me, followed by Lies Across America. And what he's done, basically, is he has debunked a lot of the mythology of American history, a lot of the inaccuracy that has either crept into our history, study of history in high school and grade school by mistake or by design.
Here's a clip from a program we did with James Loewen in 2014.
There is a historical marker in the little town of Pittsburgh, Texas. the official state historical marker put up by the Texas historical marker folks, and it says that the Wright brothers were not the first to invent the airplane. Rather, in 1902, a full year earlier, the Reverend Burrell Cannon invented an airplane in Pittsburgh, Texas, and it was briefly airborne here. And so he beat the Wright brothers. Well, I went there. I went to the only restaurant, I think, certainly the major restaurant in downtown metropolitan Pittsburgh, where they have a life-size mock-up of this airplane. And this airplane that he invented is powered by four vertically mounted paddle wheels. Now, paddle wheels work great on a river because there's a difference between water and not water. But in an airplane, they don't work so good. They pull down and they generate lift, and they pull to the rear and they generate forward movement. But then, oops, they pull back up and they ungenerate the lift, and then they pull back forward and they ungenerate the forward motion. In other words, they just spin their wheels. So it's clear just from looking at it that this aircraft was never airborne, but the state of Texas says absolutely it was. And so everybody across America who's learned the Wright brothers, I guess, has learned the wrong thing.
Jim has traveled all over this great land of ours, and he has looked at a number of these things, and he has noticed inaccuracies, some of them deliberate inaccuracies. And he insists that monuments tell us not just about the events that they supposedly describe, but they tell us just as much about the people who erected them.
I guess in a way this book had its genesis in our family vacations. My dad would stop the car for every darn historical marker or monument because he thought it was good for us.
You're kidding me. That's exactly what it used to happen with my dad. We stopped at every marker on the side of the road.
Yes, all across the country there's this dad. Well, I think these dads thought they were doing us a service, but as I unfortunately found out while writing Lies Across America, the subtitle of which is What Our Historic Sites Get Wrong, often he was, and the sites still are, doing us a disservice because a whole bunch of them are, in some cases, just silly, in other cases, just dead wrong, and in other cases, subtly wrong, in wrong that in ways that, shall we say, make us stupider after we've been there than before we stopped.
Well, what do we do to combat this?
I think the very best thing to do is to put up a historical marker right next to the monument or marker that's wrong and explain why it's wrong and why it went up. And that's happened in a few places. For example, in San Francisco, there is a huge monument called the Pioneer Monument. It's in the number one downtown square right in front of the library, and it shows a bunch of things, but one of the things it shows is a standing white man and a supine, that means lying down, right, Native American. We see these things all across the country, but it's just white supremacists right there. So what did San Francisco do about it? Well, they actually moved it when they were rebuilding the library, but they put it right back up. But then they put a big historical marker next to it. And that historical marker, which was written with the help of Native Americans, basically says, we are not all gone. We still live here. There's over 100,000 of us in California, and gives their history after their near extermination during the gold rush. So that's pretty cool.
That's historian James Lowen from a program we did in 2014. James Lowen has also figured in other programs we've did concerning the American Civil War.
One of his big targets, of course, was the mythology of the Old South and the Lost Cause. And so he wrote that book you called the Confederate Neo-Confederate Reader. That's what it's called, where he debunked it completely, especially by, you know, actually going back to the Articles of Secession adopted by so many of these Southern states, where they very specifically said that the reason they were seceding was slavery. And so we've spent more than one episode talking about the origins of the Civil War, the greatest constitutional crisis in our history. And Jim was just instrumental in laying it out in very clear terms. And beyond that, somewhat irascible terms. I don't know if you recall this, but you could always hear a hint of irritation in his voice when I would ask him about neo-Confederates or something. And you could tell he was just really irritated by things. And I got this impression of this crotchety old guy sitting by the Cracker Barrel and you know, laying down the law, but with humor as well. So Jim is an absolute delight.
Another favorite interview was with Mary Beth Tinker, who was part of a landmark Supreme Court case.
The Des Moines case, Tinker versus Des Moines. And Mary Beth Tinker was the tinker in question. It's more often called the black armband case because that's what happened. Mary Beth Tinker was 13 years old, and she was a very good student and a very conscientious and very aware student. And the big issue of the day, of course, was Vietnam in the late 1960s. And so one day she decided to wear a black armband in protest of the Vietnam War.
A lot of people thought that our parents forced us to do it, or it was their idea or something like that. That's not true at all. It was really the kids ourselves, you know, that we decided to do it. But of course, we were influenced by the values of our parents. By 1965, you know, when the war was really building up, by then my parents had become Quakers. And so then, of course, we were learning even more and more about peace. And when we saw these horrible scenes on TV of the war, I just felt so, you know, sad and that I wanted to do something about it. Like my dad always found something, a way to stand up for what he believed in. And I wanted to do the same. So us kids decided to wear black armbands to school to just mourn the dead and to say that we were sad about the war. We were doing it especially because it was a holiday time of Christmas, which is all about love and peace. And so that was also part of our message. But a couple of days before that, one of the boys, Ross Peterson, who was in on the planning at the high school, he wrote an article about it for his school paper. And so the principals heard about it. Not that we were trying to hide it from them or anything, but that's how they found out about it. So they called sort of a hasty meeting.
Oh, even before you showed up with the armbands, they were already looking for you.
They made a ruling against the armbands a day or two before we were supposed to be wearing them, which really created a huge dilemma, especially for me, because, I mean, well, maybe for all of us, but because I certainly was not a rule breaker. I mean, I was a little Methodist girl who'd become a Quaker, and I went skating on the weekends with my friend Connie, and I was very shy. And
you know, there's a technical term for what the school apparently did. It's called prior restraint. They were telling you even before you spoke that you could not speak, and that is the biggest constitutional sin one can commit when it comes to free speech. I mean, that's the most damaging type of government restriction of speech. And I hadn't realized until you just told me that's what happened here.
Yes, well, we're seeing quite a lot of that today. And especially with kids, there has always been a lot of that in the schools and in general in society. There's always been an idea that, you know, kids should be seen and not heard. Kids don't have the same rights as adults. Kids don't have these First Amendment rights. So, I mean, there does have to be some interpretation of what the rights of children are, but we felt just because we're kids, we should still have a right to express the way that we feel.
She was told to take it off or she'd be sent home, and she refused, and she got disciplined. So she sued, and the case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and that is the very famous case where the court, I have to paraphrase here, I don't have the decision in front of me, where the Supreme Court said, you know, kids have constitutional rights too, and they don't shed them at the schoolhouse gate. And that was such an important decision for freedom of speech at schools. And the rule has subsequently been narrowed a bit, but basically the idea is that schools are places where you're supposed to talk about controversial issues, where you are supposed to expose kids on an age-appropriate basis, controversial ideas, and the appropriate reaction is not to shut them down, but to have discussions, use it as a teachable moment. And a very, very important case. And we interviewed Mary Beth Tinker. She was a mature woman in her 60s at that point, but in her she had been a nurse for decades. And her retirement project was to travel around the country and talk about the importance of this case. And was she delightful? She was just so nice and so kind. And just what a great story it was, because you were hearing the 13-year-old girl's voice in her 60-year-old voice. It was just delightful.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Wayne Winkler, the executive producer of the program, talking with program host Stuart Harris as the program comes to an end, unfortunately. Stuart, did you ever in the beginning envision that this program would become something more than just a local program on WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee?
as I said, I always just envisioned this as a local show. And that would have satisfied me. And I don't know, I can't speak for you, but I'm guessing that's kind of how you thought about it too, right? It's just going to be a WETS show?
That's, yeah, originally that's how I thought of it.
Yeah, well, then there's this thing that came along, it's called a podcast. Now, again, this is 10 years ago, so podcasting was in its infancy. And I had rejected the idea of doing a podcast. I knew I had heard of podcasts. I knew that they existed. I'd probably listened to a few. But I didn't want to do something that could be done by a couple of teenagers in their basement. And that was my impression of podcasts 10 years ago, is that they were basically amateur hour. And I wanted the legitimacy of a public radio show. And so it was extremely important to me to do this first and foremost as a public radio show. But then once we got it up and running, then people kept saying, well, can I get a recording of this? I missed part of your show. Where can I get a recording? Well, okay. So then we had to go through the whole process, which at that point was kind of laborious. It was harder 10 years ago, figuring out how to do a podcast, how to find a podcast hosting site. We eventually settled upon one called Podomatic. In fact, if you want to find our podcast, just Google the name of the show, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll probably come straight up with a Podomatic site, but if not, just add the word Podomatic, one word, and you'll come to our site. And every single show we've ever done, and I think there are over 400 of them now, is archived there, and you can access them there. And that was extremely important because, you and I and Chrissy all love public radio. And I insist that public radio has many, many decades of utility and value ahead of it. But let's admit it, that it's a technology that's been around about 100 years in its current form. And, you know, the world moves on and people want podcasts. And podcasts have developed since then. In fact, to this day, I always talk about the radio show, and people who introduce me at speaking events will always say podcast. And I always have to add, well, it's a radio show first, and then it's also a podcast. Now, 10 years later, you know, there's a plethora of podcasts. There's a, wow, that's alliterative. There are lots of podcasts. It's become a cacophony, quite frankly. And so I don't begrudge anybody the same platform I have. That's great. Everybody gets to talk. But when everybody's talking, who listens? So it's very hard to get out there. Now, we get hundreds of thousands of downloads. We've had many hundreds of thousands of downloads all over the world through the podcast. I think we've actually had a couple of downloads in Madagascar. In Madagascar? Yeah. Wow, what a place. Lots and lots of downloads in the Middle East, especially during Arab Spring, you know, earlier in this past decade, when people were thinking about democracy. We've had downloads in Russia. I don't know if we've ever had any in China. I think that they're I think we've had a few in Hong Kong. All over the place. Now, obviously, our biggest distributions in English-speaking countries, you know, number one's the United States and then Great Britain, and some in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, but lots in other places as well. So that podcast was a pivotal moment. But because, again, I've always thought of this as a radio show, I decided that I wanted to get on other stations. And I don't know exactly who I think actually the idea occurred to somebody else first. And that's my very good friend, Teresa Keller, who's at WEHC, which is the public radio station out of Emory and Henry College in Southwest Virginia. And I think it was she who called me and said, I love your show on WETS, and we want to carry it on WEHC. How do we do that? And so then we kind of had to scramble. And I think eventually Chad figured it out, didn't he, how we were going to distribute the show to other stations. Chad Barrett, who's our distribution engineer. Hi, Chad. And so we figured out that we could supply this to other radio stations, which we started doing just directly at that time with file transfers. And it was after a while we discovered Public Radio Exchange, which makes it a lot easier. Then we got WVTF, the Radio IQ network, which put us all throughout Virginia, which was a huge step. And that brings us to this studio right here. And I'm looking at my bud, Chrissy Kuiper, who was instrumental in bringing Your Weekly Constitutional to WUOT, but neither one of us can remember exactly how that happened.
We heard the show. We discussed whether or not it was going to fit. And of course, at that time, we had added a second digital channel.
right,
to be able to carry a lot more programming. And that was all talk. So it fit right in.
Tremendous. Well, I do remember that it took me a while. I mean, I spent much of the last couple of decades, my summers I spent in Knoxville, where my parents had retired, and I would teach at UT, University of Tennessee, in the summers. And I was a huge Chrissy Kuiper fan. You used to do the morning edition thing. So I would hear you every morning driving down I-40 to work. And I was a member, and I had come to one or two of your open houses. And so I think that's probably where we met.
Probably so, yeah.
In fact, I seem to have a recollection. I can't swear to this, but I think I came up and I was so effusive in my fandom that you at a certain point just gave me a hug. And I think that was the beginning. You're a huggy person. And that was the beginning of that. And then, of course, I started lobbying Greg Hill.
Our programming director.
Our programming director, exactly. And Brandon Hollingsworth. Mm-hmm. I was also a fan of his. And I just wouldn't let it go. So I kept coming down and seeing you guys and saying, you know, I still got the show. You know, you can still have it if you want it. And eventually that happened. But the thing with expanding to other stations is it's a zero-sum game. By definition, every radio station in the United States is completely full, 24/7.
Yeah.
You don't have dead air, right? Unless you are a station that shuts down at night, okay? But you don't have dead air. So you literally have to convince a programming director to bump somebody else if they're going to put your show on. And they've got lots of very well-established shows and very popular shows. And every show, no matter how obscure, has its following. And program directors get a great deal of grief whenever they decide to bump something off the air. So that's hard to do. So, you know, no hard feelings that Greg had to think long and hard before he decided to carry the show. But he told me later, he said, well, Chrissy was your number one booster. And so I owe you a great debt of gratitude, Chrissy.
Oh, well, my pleasure. I'm glad I could help.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've done some good things together beyond that, haven't we? We've had other interviews over the years. You do lots of interviews just for WUOT.
Yeah.
And we've talked about some interesting constitutional issues over the years. And indeed, we've done a couple of interviews here at UOT. I recall one in particular when Chris Magra, my good buddy from the University of Tennessee, was here.
That was fun.
Wasn't it?
Oh, we did that at Blunt Mansion.
Yeah.
So we actually were able to do that in the room where the Constitution was written.
The Tennessee Constitution,
yeah.
That was great fun. And I think that subsequently we did a follow-up interview here, and I think maybe Greg produced that one. Greg was sitting where you're sitting now. And I still recall that. I recall both of them with great pleasure. But, you know, listeners to the show will have probably heard one or two of the episodes we've done on William Blunt. Thumbnail sketch. He's one of the founders of the state of Tennessee, also a signer of the U.S. Constitution. His house is right here in Knoxville. It's called Blunt Mansion. Wonderful place. I sit on the board of it. In fact, I've got a board meeting at noon today. So as soon as we finish here, I'm going to have to go over to Blunt Mansion and do a board meeting. Wonderful, wonderful place. Fascinating fellow. It's Tennessee. It's not just Knoxville's, but Tennessee's claim to constitutional fame. And the guy was a complete scoundrel.
I was going to say colorful, but I guess scoundrel kind of covers it.
Well, yeah. Our executive director, David Hearns, always winces a little bit when I say that. And so I kind of needle him with it. He'll say, well, no, he was a man of his times, and he had his good boy. That's fine. But he was kind of a sleazebag, too. And
he was kind of a sleazebag, too.
And he was doing things like speculating, based on his insider information, using his office for all sorts of personal gain. And when everything went south, he tried to engage in a conspiracy to commit treason against the United States, again, for his personal gain.
Yes.
I mean, he was a complete sleazebag, but sorry, Dave. but that makes him interesting, right? And that's why we're all sitting here kind of laughing about it. And I remember Chris Magra, who is a legitimate historian. I'm a constitutional law professor, but he's a real historian of American history, especially that era. And he'd never really paid a lot of attention to William Blunt. I don't know exactly how. It was maybe I who contacted him, or maybe somebody else in the board did, but he's now on our board too.
Okay.
And he really picked up on William Blunt, and he sat in the studio and we started talking about, it was during the impeachment. That was it. It was during the impeachment, the second impeachment or first impeachment trial of Donald Trump. And we were talking about and comparing that impeachment to William Blunt's impeachment. And boy, Chris just got very, shall we say, enthusiastic about the process. We still laugh about that. He was just really adamant about some of the historical precedents that Blunt had set. So that was a great interview, too.
Fun.
Yeah.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I am executive producer Wayne Winkler, talking with Stuart Harris, the host of the program, and Chrissy Kuiper from WUOT-FM in Knoxville, Tennessee, a longtime booster of the program. We'll be back in just a moment. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Wayne Winkler, the executive producer of the program, with Stuart Harris, the regular program host, and Chrissy Kuiper from WUOT-FM in Knoxville, Tennessee. Many times we've done programs on people that we would consider heroes of the Constitution, people who did wonderful things. But sometimes it's more fun to talk about the scoundrels, isn't it?
I'm so glad that you said that, Wayne, because that's, again, part of our mission is to tell unvarnished American history. And we've been doing that for a decade. And I'm so glad to see that there's much more of a movement in that direction now. You see a lot of people who are complaining about the whitewashing of American history. Well, that's happened. And part of that process of whitewashing is not merely ignoring the contributions of Black people and other minorities and women. It is it's just making American history sort of boring. You know, it's this idea that you have all these founders standing up there on their pedestals and that they've been guiding us on this, you know, gradual and always upward heading course of greater freedom and prosperity and yay, U.S. and aren't we great and I'm proud to be an American. Well, okay, that's fine. The United States is a great country and, you know, we are proud and pleased and to be here and all the rest of it, but that's not how it happened. You know, we're all human beings. We're not marble statues. And even our greatest heroes, even somebody like James Madison, well, he was a slave owner. And that's another reason I'm so proud of my association with Montpelier is that they are facing that front and center. They've got an award-winning exhibit there called The Mere Distinction of Color, especially about slavery and the enslaved community at Montpelier. They just recently moved to make the descendants of the enslaved community at Montpelier equal partners on the board of directors of Montpelier. They face those issues. And so, you know, just as James Madison was complex and just as he had his faults, some of them major, pretty much we all do. And so when we look at constitutional history, we have to look at the bad as well as the good. Chrissy, do you have a favorite part of this show or a favorite episode of this show as you think back over it?
No, I don't play favorites that way. Oh, okay. I do have a question, though, yeah. About how the last 10 years, whether or not it has changed how you think of constitutional law as it applies to regular people.
Absolutely. It's definitely been an evolution for me, too. I like to say that we're all ignorant. It's just how ignorant are we on a particular subject? I just happen to be a little bit less ignorant on constitutional law than the average person, but I'm still learning every day. I have learned so much from my guests. Some of the cases we talked about, like the Black Armband case and Mary Beth Tinker, I knew the basic story, but she deepened my knowledge. And in fact, she shifted my knowledge some. And that happened almost every time I did an interview, something of that nature. In a macro sense, I think maybe my perspective has shifted from what I was brought up with, which is to think of the Constitution in the colonial Williamsburg setting. You know, everybody's wearing tri-cornered hat, and it's basically a bunch of white guys sitting around debating lofty principles. Well, that's great. That's only part of the story. And so we shifted a lot more to the modern days. We talked a lot more about the civil rights era. We talked a lot more about women. What a concept. In fact, some of my very favorite interviews over the year have been with your friend and mine, Wanda Sobieski. Hi, Wanda. Right here in Knoxville. That's a funny story. I was teaching at UT one summer, and the dean at that time was John Sobieski, Wanda's husband. And as I did every summer, I would go around and talk to my colleagues there, and I'd say, I'm looking for other subjects for the radio show? Are you doing any interesting work? And I've interviewed several UT people over the years, and we've had great interviews. Penny White gave a particularly good one some years ago, the former justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court, who teaches there now, delightful woman. But one day John Sobieski said, well, no, you know, I don't really have anything, but you should talk to my wife. She knows everything about women's rights, and especially about women's suffrage. And so I said, sure. And Wanda, it turns out, is an attorney in her own right and a very respected attorney here in East Tennessee. And she has her own law offices right on Gay Street. And I went, and it's an old radio station by coincidence, and refurbished. And went over there and we talked to her. And she gave me an encyclopedic 2-hour interview on the history of women's suffrage. And that's where I learned for the first time that women's suffrage ended right here in Tennessee, in a huge climax in the state capitol, which came down to a single vote and a fellow by the name of Byrne. And
Harry
and
Byrne.
Harry Byrne and his mother. And her mother's an unusual, his mother has an unusual name, Feb Byrne. And there's a statue of Feb and Harry Byrne right in downtown Knoxville next to the Historical Society. I'm not going to give the ending of that story away. I'll simply encourage people to go to the podcast site, use the search bar, put in suffrage or women's suffrage. It is a fantastic story. And Wanda tells it amazingly well, and did several subsequent interviews with Wanda over the years, typically about women's rights. So, yes, I mean, I started thinking about the Constitution not just as a bunch of guy in knee breeches and wigs, but as people today, every day, people of color, women, and how it affects us. And, of course, we see it all the time in the newspaper now, don't we? We talk about religious freedom. We talk about gay rights. Oh, we've done lots of stuff on gay rights. First Amendment issues come up all the time. In fact, I should give a shout out to the guy I call our First Amendment guy, Doug McKechnie, a former colleague of mine at the Appalachian School of Law, who now teaches at the U.S. Air Force Academy. Doug has been on the show so many times talking about his area, the First Amendment, that, wow, thank you, Doug. He's got to be one of our best guests, don't you think, Wayne?
One of our best and certainly one of our most frequent guests. Stuart, in the time we have left, I want to talk about your vision of the Constitution and its role in the future of this nation. During the past 15 months or so, when we have been out of production, it's been very frustrating because it seems like every week there was a new constitutional issue coming up, and we didn't have the opportunity to explore that and interview people who might be able to shed some light on that. But one thing I think is that people from all across the political spectrum look at the Constitution and feel that somehow it's not up to the task that it's facing today, and certainly not up to the tasks it's going to face in the future. What do you think about that? Is the Constitution going to get us through all this? Is it up to it?
Well, yes, I do think our Constitution has endured and that it will endure. And it's the oldest functioning Constitution in the world. I mean, continuously functioning. We are the world's oldest continuously functioning representative democracy. But yes, I think we've got some major problems. And I think probably the one that comes to mind most and really been revealed over the past couple of years is that we're shifting away from majority rule. Now, I recognize we're not a pure democracy. The founders did not want a pure democracy. They wanted buffers between the people, who at that time were not as educated or sophisticated as people are today, who didn't have modern communication. They wanted buffers between those people and the people who they thought should be the leaders of the country, people like them, basically rich white men who would have the necessary education and civic virtue to run things. And that's rather elitist conception, isn't it? Now, maybe it was appropriate 200 some odd years ago. I'm not going to say it wasn't. But, you know, we've expanded the franchise enormously since then. We're allowing the majority of people, that would be people of the female persuasion, to vote and participate. And guess what? As they and as black people and other minorities are participating more fully, we're seeing there's some structural problems. You know, there are problems with the fact that the United States Senate gives equal representation to every state. So people in North Dakota, and there aren't that many of them, have exactly the same powers as people of California in the United States Senate. And there are a lot more of them. And so the Senate means effectively that Congress is not representative of the people at large. The Electoral College has come under great scrutiny because what used to be a historical anomaly that somebody would, you know, win the popular vote but lose the Electoral College, well, it's happened now twice in the last 20 years, hasn't it? I realize, again, we're not a pure democracy, but when you get to a point where the majority is no longer controlling things, then that's a real problem, and people start to get upset. People start to lose faith in the system. Gerrymandering is another huge issue. And so these are issues that we have to address. I mean, the majority really should, in most cases, rule. Maybe not in every single election, maybe not in every single instance, but by and large, the majority should rule. And I think we do need some reforms to voting rights and maybe to the Constitution itself to make sure that we're closer to majority rule than we've become in the last few decades.
One thing that I'm going to miss very much is producing the Daily Constitutional. Your Daily Constitutional is a 90-second program heard on WETS and a few of the other stations. It's an examination of current events and how they relate to constitutional issues. And it's always tagged with what I like to think of as an appropriate song. But that was a lot of fun to produce, a lot of challenges in getting all that information into 90 seconds, but it was really a lot of fun.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. The Daily is something that we haven't really pushed out there like the others. It's mostly a Johnson City thing. But whenever I speak to people in Johnson City and they comment on the show, it's almost always about The Daily because they will listen to that with their kids in the car going to and from school or work. And they really love that show, and they especially love the funny music that you pick to go along with the subjects. We did get in trouble once or twice when people didn't like your selection of music, but I always did. Well, if you don't occasionally offend somebody, then you know you're not doing your job. Yeah, and you did your job, Wayne. You really did. Let me just say this about that. I know we're leaving, but the podcast site is still up. I don't know how long it will remain up, but certainly for the next few months. So please, if you want to listen to some older episodes, or if you want to download them and save them, and yeah, I don't know if you're a teacher, you want to use them in a classroom, or you just want them for your own use, to share them with others, please go ahead and start downloading them now. Go to the podcast site, and again, that's just Google Your Weekly Constitutional, and download and listen now, and you can make sure that you have the episodes that you want, and you can keep them for the rest of your life, or as long as the files don't degenerate. Chrissy, do you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I think, I mean, you've clearly enjoyed the last 10 years, and it's going to be sad to hear you go, but
well, it doesn't
you're
mean
not we're, leaving. We're I not, mean, you're not going to stop doing what you do.
I'm old.
We'll hear from you again, I'm sure.
I'm old and decrepit, but I'm not dead yet. And so, as we were discussing beforehand, you know, I'm always available to come over to UOT or to ETS for that matter, and talk about something on an ad hoc basis. And, you know, maybe there will be future collaborations ahead. So stay tuned.
Well, Stuart, I just want to say that I'm very proud of the work that we've done. I think we've enlightened a lot of people about the Constitution and what it says and what it doesn't say. And it's been a real pleasure working with you for this past decade. So thank you very much for that opportunity. And now, for one last time, give us the sign-off.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to all of our guests and to our executive producer, Wayne Winkler, our distribution engineer, Chad Barrett. Thanks also very much to Hannibal's Elephants, who do our music, headed by, I have to say again, my son Benjamin Harris. And thanks to all of our listeners over the years, because you were why we did this and you were what made it possible. So thank you for your loyalty. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.